This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
Yeah, first of all, I'd like to acknowledge the traditional owners of Canberra, welcome visitors from overseas, Northern Australia and everywhere else, especially the Indigenous representatives. And I noticed that Tiwi mob, who are sort of really passing through Canberra on another cultural tour, sort of just walked in a few minutes ago. And so it's incredible who we've got in town. But I want to say a special welcome and thank you to the people from Groote Eylandt and to the members of the Blitner family who helped me so much and encouraged the recording of Jerry. And that's to Annie and Peter, Annie and Peter Lang, to Irma, to Wendy, to Donald Blitner. So thank you, all of you, for encouraging this. The first base for the Arnhem Land Expedition was at Umbercumber on the east coast of Groote Eylandt. An Aboriginal camping place for millennia, its position in the modern atlas dates from the 1930s, when it became a refuelling base for the Qantas Empire flying boats that travelled between Sydney and the south of England. Now, since the war, Umbercumber had grown and morphed to the extent that officials in Darwin had come to cautiously recognise it as an Aboriginal settlement, intended in some way, some indeterminate way, for the betterment of the local population. Elsewhere in the Gulf, missionaries had been entrusted as the agents of this civilising process. Umbercumber, in contrast, was effectively the initiative of a solitary individual, a self-styled superintendent called Frederick Harold Gray, who is said to have developed it in protest of missionary methods. Peter Bassett Smith called him a privateer, which I think is an interesting term. Within days of getting there, the Australian Museum anthropologist Fred McCarthy was expressing disappointment in his diary. "I went to bed 9 p.m. though tired out, couldn't sleep because of our situation. Here we are, 16 of us, backed by US and Australian funds, but the natives are almost completely civilised, speaking English well and have dropped their ceremonial and hunting life." The notion that Arnhem Land was a mysterious and pristine heartland, an Aboriginal enclave unpolluted by modernity, was not singular to McCarthy. It was one of the collective fantasies that gave rise to the 1948 expedition. As a newspaper of the period explained, "The natives in Arnhem Land are particularly interesting to the American scientists because they have never developed beyond the Stone Age." Now, as much as the expedition was constructed and promoted as a quest to discover antiquity, it is better thought of as a symptom of modernity. And we see it in the expedition photographs, where Aboriginal performers have their voices recorded or watch with fascination as the scientists go about their work, busy at the technological forefront. That juxtaposition of old ways and new ways is a formula repeated in image after image. This was the expedition's comfort zone, the way it declared its raison d'etre, as is not surprising. To define modernity by staging an encounter with a supposed antiquity is as old as modernity itself. The expedition properly began when it arrived at Umbercumber, expecting some fossil society where men, as they called people, lived in a state of nature. But instead they found what you always find when human beings are involved, a place defined by the forces of history. Umbercumber was the place where the expedition met with Gerald, or Jerry, Blitner, whom I interviewed at his home in Darwin in 2007. And I was referred to him by Sally May, who had told me with excitement of meeting this Aboriginal man who had guided the expedition at Groote Eylandt. The news that there was an Aboriginal person still living who had detailed memories of the expedition was surprising and very exciting. A year earlier, I'd gone to the expedition's three main bases to see what memories remained of its visits. And while a few elders dimly recalled it, and many more helped interpret the photography and collections it generated, no one could offer at that stage substantial testimony. It seemed that everyone who worked closely with the expedition had passed away. But Gerald Blitner was born in 1920, which means that he was 28 when the expedition came through. He was not a kid. And not only was he a witness, but he was an active participant in the proceedings. His involvement, as he explained it, included guiding, translating, and many other duties. He skippered the Wanderer, the boat owned by Fred Gray, that ferried the researchers around the coast of Groot and across to nearby islands. Now, as Jerry's story began to develop, it became clear that he created a role as an unofficial go-between, a position that involved translation in the linguistic sense and more. Now, as we know from McCarthy, there were others at Umbercumber who spoke English, but most of them were young. It was the older people, most learned in law and culture, that were of particular interest to Fred McCarthy, Frank Setzler, and Charles Mountford, the three anthropological researchers. Jerry served as a conduit, moving back and forth between scientists and the locals. He was party to both sides of the negotiations. His position is best thought of as a cultural broker or intermediary. And the term cultural broker is one that gained currency among North American historians in the 1990s, but is used less often in Australia. It refers to a kind of specialist that emerged in nearly all situations of colonial contact and occupation. And as the historian Margaret Connell Sass explains it, cultural brokers devised ways of penetrating the borders between disparate peoples. Finding porosity in those boundaries, they forged pathways that link peoples rather than barriers that separate them. Trade, translation, and diplomacy are among the roles assumed by such people. So how did Jerry Blitner come to occupy this role at Umbercumber? To answer this question, we must go back into Jerry's personal history and into the history of the Gulf Country in the early 20th century. As he explained it, Jerry was not born on Groot, but on the mainland, somewhere in the vicinity of Borroloola. And much of what Jerry knew about his earliest days was told to him by the patrol officer Bill Harney, who would join the expedition at its second base, Yirrkala, as official guide. Jerry's parents and another woman, who was actually his father's other wife, pose in this photograph, dated 1919, a year before he was born, according to the dating. This is held in the Mitchell Library. And the two children, one hiding, are presumably Jerry's elder siblings, Margaret and Fred. You have to listen carefully. This is sort of somewhat raw footage from the recording. But here is Jerry talking about his early days.
I wonder if you could start by telling me where you were born and what were your early memories.
Should I go back to where the missions were?
Please.
I should, by rights, I think, go back. When the white men came in and they to work with the Aboriginal people, and they fell in love with some woman, or the woman fell in love with him or whatever, and that's how we came to be. And my father, when he came to MacArthur River, Borroloola, according to Bill Harney, he spoke to me many times. I called him like an uncle.
That being Bill Harney, as an uncle to you?
We all used to call him uncle. But my father, he decided to somehow he bought a couple of boats, and he was doing beach timber work, tree banking, that is.
Yeah. What was your father's name?
My father was Frederick Charles Blitner. They reckon German descent, you know. I don't know what nationality Bill Harney was, but he's a jolly good storyteller. And if you didn't listen to him, well, you'd be the one who'd miss out. So every time he spoke, I'd listen to Uncle.
Let me ask you about your mother. What was her name?
Well, her name was... I'll go back to this thing.
Oh, okay.
Therefore, our Aboriginal people did a wonderful thing. Would be early mob. And that's how my mother and father fell in love out on the Vandenaden group.
So early in Jerry's life, his father decided to leave the Gulf and enter the cattle industry further south. And he left the family at Roper River Mission, now Nuukur, established in 1908 by the Church Missionary Society that I'll refer to as the CMS, an organisation run and financed by the evangelical wing of the Anglican Church. Jerry lived there until the age of four, and it was then that the missionaries separated from his mother and took him to the CMS mission on Groote Eylandt, an institution for so-called half-caste children, who it was thought appropriate to protect from the degradation of the blacks' camps. I quote, "Jerry had a mission upbringing, learnt to read and write in English, practised as a Christian, and acquired a range of skills ranging from spearfishing to sailing. He also formed connections with the Aboriginal people who lived near the mission. He learnt about their culture and was inducted into ceremonial traditions and became fluent in Anindilyakwa, the language native to Groote. He regarded Aboriginal and Christian religion as essentially compatible." Now, as the years passed, Jerry was adopted into the local kinship system, acquiring the host of fathers, mothers, brothers and sisters, whom he refers to in the interview. And perhaps this in some way helps explain his apparent success in navigating the trauma and separation from his birth parents so early in life. Though another factor is that he did on occasions visit the Roper Mission, so he did not entirely lose his relationship with his mother, as did other members of what's become known as the Stolen Generations. Now, at nearly 2,500 square kilometres, Groote, meaning Great Island, is the largest in an archipelago of islands and reefs. Bickerton, situated southeast of Blue Mud Bay and west of Groote, is the second largest and sufficiently close to the mainland to allow a hop between coast and islands. For centuries, people have been making this journey by canoe, a process of migration onto the island that continued until well into the 20th century. World War II brought a strong military presence to the island. Jerry worked for the Royal Australian Air Force on the construction of an airstrip near the mission. Prior to the expedition's arrival, he accepted an offer from Fred Gray to come and work at his settlement. Blitner recalled the arrival of the expedition in April 1948, and footage shot later by Hal Walker allows us to visualise the scene. So we'll listen to Jerry, and if we could just move to the DVD.
The party all landed. We had all the tents up and all the water system up there with pipes, you know, running it along there, make it easier for them. And they started. And boy, the biggest humbug, you know, big thing to do. And Hal Walker wanted all the shots he could get. Frank Setzler, he wanted all the bones that he could find and all the Macassan heads that he could see. And Miller wanted every fish that he could see and an illustration about them. And P.C. Manford, I've thought, and I was told by a couple of the people, he was a self-proclaimed anthropologist, and he acted that way.
How did he act?
He had a sort of a tyrant, you know. He wanted it all his way, his way, his way. And he kept on. And I took him out, first I remember, I took him out to the side of Bickerton there. The two lovely rocks like that, you know.
I'll just keep going while we get to the end of this bit of footage. Gerald Blitner was the Jerry mentioned by Smithsonian anthropologist Frank Setzler. And he wrote of Gray's boat coming to meet them, towing a dinghy made by Jerry, a half-caste and Gray's right-hand man. Mountford's first mention occurred 2 days later on 7th of April, when Jerry the half-caste ventured his opinion that the rock art on Groote had been painted not by the original Groote Islanders, but by more recent arrivals from the mainland. And to this Mountford wrote, "Jerry's information totally unreliable." Some days later, however, he had risen slightly in Mountford's opinion. Jerry the half-caste gave some interesting information about burials, but Mountford remained cautious. When Jerry won a mention in the expedition diaries, it was usually with the descriptor half-caste, always implying a lack of authenticity. As a functionary of the expedition, he was accepted and even taken for granted. But as someone of mixed race, he was of no use to Setzler's investigation of physical anthropology and was considered of highly limited value as an ethnographic informant. As a photographic subject, he was mostly avoided as a waste of film. And my heart sank when I showed Jerry the 1949 National Geographic article on the expedition by Mountford. Given all he had done to support it, he expected to find a photo of himself. There was none, and his disappointment was palpable. Setzler took just one photo of Jerry, and unusually for him, it was technically poor. Setzler's task was made that much more difficult by the fact that Jerry was seated in the shade of the sail and was thus heightening the contrast between him and the glare on the water. But I think of this photo as acquiring really an accidental symbolism, a darkening of Jerry to the point that his identity is obscured. And Setzler never printed the negative or selected it for one of the set of lantern slides that he afterwards used in his illustrated lectures. And so Jerry, in this part of the visual record, just hovers on the edge of invisibility. Now, the expedition's absorption of racial ideology is never more explicit than in its treatment of Gerald Blüttner. From the age of four, when he was catapulted into his new life on the island, Jerry's mixed parentage had directed the course of his life. His marginality, his invisibility, his alleged unreliability, in the opinion of Mountford and others, must have been apparent to him. And I wonder whether his tendency to put himself centre stage in every story he told was not in some way an after-the-fact bid for compensation at the way his supposed racial hybridity had pushed him out of the picture in his dealings with the expedition and so much else. Characteristically, he never buckled to the typecasting. For him, having mixed heritage was more like a form of dual nationality, an asset rather than a hindrance, since his was a knowledge rooted in both worlds. And several times in the interview he spoke about this, that he could draw on both blackfellow and whitefellow wisdom. Now, Jerry's linguistic talents, combined with building and carpentry skills and a strong aptitude for work, certainly made him attractive to Fred Gray, attractive as a prospective employee. And Gray had no quarrel with half-castes. In fact, he preferred them, as we know from a comment in Setzler's notebook. Setzler wrote, "Since 1932, Mr. F.H. Gray has tried to improve the natives, both on the mainland and on Groote. He feels his experiments have been failures and thinks the only way of improving their lot is by adding fresh blood, possibly some white blood, to make half-castes whom he thinks are superior." So, who was this Fred Gray who played such a part in Jerry's life as a young man and in the life of the expedition? Now, Fred Gray was a native of Worcestershire who emigrated to Australia in his mid-20s. And he had lived mainly in the Gulf Country since 1932, which by 1948 made him a veteran of the region. An interest in tree-panging, similar to Jerry's father, brought him to coastal Arnhem Land, where he developed contacts with the local clans. And Gray was close to several episodes of frontier violence in 1932, beginning in Caledon Bay, where five Japanese fishermen were fatally speared. Then the slaying of a sergeant on Wooder Island and the deaths around this time of two imprudent sightseers in an unrelated incident prompted media hysteria about murderous savages. So Gray was involved in bringing the Yolngu elders Dakia and Merera and three other men who admitted involvement in the violence to Darwin, where they faced the justice system, a term I use very loosely indeed. The goodwill Gray won with the government at that time served him later years as he developed the settlement at Umbercumber. Now, when construction of the Qantas base commenced in the 30s, Gray found employment organising an Aboriginal workforce and that numbered about 200. So it was Aboriginal labour predominantly that built the Qantas base. Construction ended, but the population at Umbercumber remained, and so did Gray. At what point he adopted the title superintendent is difficult to tell. But as a white man among Aborigines, he saw himself in a position of leadership. Establishing gardens and bringing goats to the island, he maintained a trickle of income by supplying food to the personnel who manned the base. And he struck up a relationship with Frederick Rose, a meteorologist and British-trained anthropologist who did foundational kinship study in his spare time. Rose returned to Umbercumber with the settlement and stayed for some weeks, helping set up the anthropological research. Now, Jerry cast Gray as an authoritarian figure. We'll hear a few comments about what he said.
Gray been chasing me since 1934. He kept on asking me, come on, you're a lovely boy, come and work for me. And I said, you're a bad man.
Why did you think he was a bad man?
Well, I heard people talking, and you can't do more than obey.
Did the missionaries like him?
Yeah, missionaries loved him.
Did they?
Yeah, because he had that power to overcome by covering his bad stuff. I liked him, but I still didn't like a lot of his ways, like beating, molesting black fellows sometimes.
What do you mean molesting them?
Well, belting him, hitting him with sticks just for the fun, because he's a white man.
And he did that because he ran a sort of settlement there, didn't he?
Yeah, he was a superintendent. It was his settlement. How about I'll get off?
So he beat people who lived at the settlement?
Yeah, well, he started there in 1936, and I fell for his, what you call it, might be his ways.
His charm?
And his charm. And he said, look, there's an expedition coming. That's why I asked you to come up. For 2 weeks, and then Dick Harris gave me you to do the boy.
Now, Jerry, who rather disliked speaking ill of anyone, had an ambivalent attitude to Gray, and some sentimental feelings must have lingered, for a photograph of the two of them, taken years later, hung on Jerry's wall when we did the interview. Fred Rose later commented that Gray was no philanthropist, and to implement his schemes he exploited the Aborigines, especially their ignorance of money. He exploited a loophole in the child endowment system that allowed any institution that kept children in dormitories to receive funds and use them for its own ends. And so Gray, or rather his Aboriginal labourers, built dormitories where the children were compelled to sleep, and he could then claim the allowance. Parents camped nearby to be close to the children, and some took up work in the gardens. Gray could claim success in his civilising project. And the constant pressure to demonstrate the usefulness of the settlement and suspicion about the sexual motives of a white man in his position may have contributed to his decision to propose by telegram to Marjorie Southwick, a schoolteacher he had known in England but not seen for more than 20 years. Now, her decision to accept and migrate from the south of England to be with Fred is perhaps less explicable. It's Bessie Mountford, whose diary best registered the emotional pulse of the expedition, makes it plain that Marjorie, even very early in her marriage, was abysmally unhappy. And the bizarre world she had come to is apparent in Walker's film footage. So we'll just go into a little bit more film of Umbercumber. I think her husband's propensity to unnerve the pen pushers at Native Affairs is evident here in all its glory. Not for Gray, the pith helmets and safari suits worn by Mountford and the likes. Gray pared down his wardrobe to almost nothing. A loincloth or naga-naga was his usual apparel, as Jerry told me when we watched this footage. And here's Gray supervising a boxing match between boys from the dormitory. So, as an agent of civilization, Gray was, I think, unpredictable. The suspicion lingered that this beachcomber type had gone native, and eventually Native Affairs forced him to leave the settlement, although he was actually allowed to sell it to the CMS and for some thousands of pounds. Jerry claimed that the impending arrival of the expedition was the reason why Gray renewed pressure on him to come and work. Knowing that the settlement would be under the spotlight, a makeover seemed appropriate. Gray had recently acquired an engine for pumping water, and with Jerry's input and inability to mobilise the Umbercumber community, the gardens were expanded to cover about 12 acres. The Mountford mob come in at just the right time, he explained. The garden was flourishing and the whole place shipshape. And Jerry beamed proudly when he told of Mountford's effusive praise for the setup, which he described Mountford described it as the best Aboriginal settlement he had ever seen. But privately, however, I think Mountford must have been alarmed at this conspicuous display of civilization, which McCarthy and others immediately identified as a failure in his planning. So landed in this imbroglio, the expedition's three ethnological researchers pursued lines of inquiry that took them as far as possible from the queer spectacle of Umbacumba. So as physical anthropologist, Setzler searched for bones and other markers of racial uniqueness, McCarthy hunted for ancient rock art, and Mountford collected totemic symbols in the form of bark paintings and studied music and ceremony that seemed safely quarantined from historical influence. So while the anthropologists look back in time and away from the settlement, hankering for the Stone Age, Hal Walker from National Geographic turned his lens upon the Greys and Umbacumba, and that's what we're seeing in this photography. One of the interesting things that that Walker did, and I don't know the location of these photographs, but they are photographs, and they weren't the sort of photograph that Mountford circulated at all, because he tended to conceal his methods. But these photographs show the economic exchange that was taking place. And you can identify some of the goods, needles and threads, little mirrors, lengths of cloth that the goods are wrapped in. And so that the expedition was in certain ways an imposition on the settlements that it visited, but it also brought material and other sorts of benefits. And I don't think that we can make much sense of the expedition unless we really grasp this rather prickly paradox. Jerry, however, never benefited from the largesse, and we've got some film, but I think really for time we'll have to avoid that. But it does show Mountford distributing small cubes of tobacco. Regular distribution of tobacco was another way in which both missionaries and then the expedition maintained loyalty, and it functioned really as currency in this sort of situation. And certainly most of the paintings and all the sorts of things collected were acquired through exchanges of tobacco. And so Walker actually did very interesting work in, giving us some record of these economic exchanges. Now, there were some members of the expedition who Jerry remembered with great fondness, and certainly with the greatest fondness was the ichthyologist Robert Miller. And Jerry played quite a role in developing his large collection of fish specimens from the island. And the warmth between Jerry and Bob Miller is, I think, reflected in these photographs. And here we have Jerry as a young man with his wife, Jessie, and also son, Donald, who is here with us at this event. Jerry's relationship with Mountford was far less harmonious, and he quickly became convinced that Mountford was personally hogging the resources of the settlement and the assistance of the Aboriginal people. So we're going to just quickly hear a little bit of what Jerry said about this.
Did Mountford get on well with Fred Gray, or did they have a bad relationship?
No, they used to have a bit of arguments, you know.
What about?
About things. Their work, I think, their work more than anything, because he was getting more trips than any other soul on board that expedition. When Frank Setzler and Miller got to know me really, you know, they said, "Hey, we want you to help us." I said, "What do you want?" He said, "You're the skipper of the boat, and you get permission from John, an Australian guy, who gave up cooking, and he was fitting with beetles." Yeah, beetles, galore. And he said, "You talk to John and say that we're not happy in the amount of work, more freedom with the boat, and the use of Mr. Blitner and some Aboriginals. And we want to see some of the islands too. So I went and spoke to Dr. Settler and Miller and some English guys, doctors. It's their turn to go out and see something. So I gave him Mary Ellen. I gave Mansford Mary Ellen, you know.
Gee.
I worked for those.
Tell me what you said to him.
No, I mean, I gave him more, I gave them more than I gave Mansford.
Oh, right.
And I knew where a lot of the rocks were then. Right.
And so it's an interesting confession because it shows how certain disagreements within the expedition party were actually influencing the interpretation that Jerry and others at Umbacumba were making of them and the sorts of and their own processes of decision making that were going on there. I'm going to play one more track, and it just. It's only a short one, but it does give an insight into some of the more controversial issues, certainly from an Umbacumba point of view, to do with the things that Mountford was dealing with, and particularly his desire to record and to film secret sacred ceremony. And to paraphrase Jerry's position on this, he cast Mountford as something of a bull in the china shop. Jerry was deeply unnerved when Mountford listed a number of ceremonies that he hoped to witness during his residence on the island. And this is what, you know, his comment, Beatles galore. We have the photo here of John Bray, who he was talking about there. It's a lot of his memories.
So you're telling me very important information, which is that you feel that Mr. Mountford was... really asking for things that were very sacred, and that he shouldn't know.
He got onto trying to pick up stuff from the mission mob, you know. There was a fellow, some Walker or someone, American guy.
Is that Hal Walker?
Yeah, Hal Walker. Eh?
Yeah.
No.
The photographer?
No. Not that one. Another one.
Warner.
Warner, I think. He made a book.
Who was there earlier? Yes.
He thought he was going to get stuff like that. Well, Warner was doing things very quietly, you know, with man to man. But Mountford wanted to be very, very abrupt and the man. He wanted to be the man to find this, to give Australia that. And I kept on talking. Maybe you're trying to go too far, because dropping in on an island like this, though our old people, our old, my old father, Nokor of a banjo, and my nephew Charlie, and our old man Papa Tama, and my uncle, and I called him that.
Because they were mainland people who'd moved over to Groot?
Yeah. Oh,
so you mentioned banjo... These are quite well-known names. Yep.
So, I mean, quite an extraordinary revelation there that Jerry remembered the book they were reading, which is confirmed in the expedition diaries, that he was reading A Black Civilization by Lloyd Warner, an early American ethnographer in the area, and, in fact, comparing the approaches of these different researchers. So I'm going to quickly, I'll wind up now and just take you through a few photographs. I found this one, which is, I think, my favourite photograph of Jerry. He went with Hal Walker to the Roper River before Hal went to Yirrkala, so at the end of the Groot stay, and his shooting of a crocodile and skinning it and having this photographed and filmed by Hal was one of his wonderful proud moments, and it was a great disappointment that I couldn't get to share some of these photographs with him because I think they really do restore him to the record. But unfortunately, they were never published. So you know, here at last, we have something that represents him rather beautifully. At the end of the interview, he told me he was deeply grateful he had done it. For he himself was surprised by the wealth of recollections it prompted. And the dialogue we enjoyed, I think, says much about the impact of the expedition still rippling and resonating 60 years on. So, thank you.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.